Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, Samsung Enterprise SSDs benchmarked iPad Pro. Bent is the new normal. Crucial's new NVMe SSDs are a steal. Sweet earbuds from Periodic Audio. Size Ninja 5 and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 496, recorded on December 20th, 2018. ZSSDs not just for big companies anymore. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by OnDeck. Are you a small business owner in need of capital today? Well, OnDeck can help. With over $10 billion in loans and an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, OnDeck is a lender you can trust. Visit OnDeck.com/Twitch to learn more and receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at RocketMortgage.com/twit. And by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. You can save $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/twitch and using the promo code Twitch at checkout. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most delightful, most engaging, most useful. Why am I talking this fast? We're a hardware show, people. We're here to talk to you about hardware. I'm Patrick Norton. Joining me is Mr. Alan Malventano. How you doing, sir?
Pretty good. Been busy. Testing the things.
You finally achieved, I think, like, big bucket list check for you. You finally got to test Samsung's Enterprise SSDs.
I did. They've gone the longest time always announcing these awesome Enterprise parts that only a few select very large companies have ever been able to touch. They've always been, like, kind of secretive about these things as far as, you know, they don't really sample them for review because they don't need to convince other people to buy them because they were only selling them to just these, you know, very small number of companies, right? Which was kind of a pain because they were also announcing really cool things, right? Like this Z SSD, which we actually got our hands on and tested, which has what they call Z NAND instead of V NAND, which is supposed to be NAND memory that runs way faster than usual NAND to the point where it's supposed to encroach into Optane territory. And
really?
As we know that Optane stuff, super low latency, like a fraction of what NAND flash can do. And here Samsung's like, well, we can just make our flash go faster. Oh, really? so they have. It's pretty good stuff. It was a beast of a review for us to get through because mm-hmm. they sent me 8 Enterprise SSDs. And one Enterprise SSD takes like a day or two to get through as far as all the testing and just, you know, looking at all the results and making sure everything worked properly. And it's just a lot of work to do. But I was more than happy to do it because, you know, the first Enterprise SSDs that are available to normal folk like these will eventually be on Newegg. I believe you can even order them right now from the Samsung site directly. It's just really nice. Right. Again, they're not for average Joe, but they're, you know, workstation user. You have a database kind of workload. You have something that's going to be more of what would be considered an enterprise-y style workload where, you know, picture you have something on the drive that you're just randomly writing to across the entire span of the drive. That's the kind of a workload that you would never want to hit a consumer SSD with because it would just not be very happy and the performance would not be that good. It would start, you know, being real stuttery and just having a hard time keeping up with what's going on. These drives, all of them, all, from SATA all the way up to NVMe, PCI Express, add-in card style, basically they're just covering the whole round here, the whole gamut of, any kind of interface you could want. Chances are they've got it covered here. These drives are able to handle those heavier workloads in such a way that they can do so very consistently. Sometimes they might not be as quick as a consumer SSD fresh out of the box where you just installed Windows to it and that's all you've done. But that consumer SSD would slow down considerably if you were to put heavier workloads on it and do random writes to, you know, more of the space and stuff like that. Whereas these, it's more like not slow and steady wins the race, but moderately fast and steady wins the race. And the steady part of that term comes about when you talk about this thing called quality of service, which is how consistent the drive is. So how consistent is it able to go whatever that certain speed is? Is it ever going to hiccup and go a little bit slower for some reason? And I don't want to get into the minutiae of the details, but like if you're an enterprise kind of customer slash listener of this podcast, you know what QoS means. You know what you might be looking for. You know how consistent you might want these things to be. And that's what I focused on going through all the charts in this review, is comparing the maximum performance specs and the quality of service specs of each particular model against, like, comparing their specs, their stated, you know, this is how good it's going to be, against what we measured it to be. And I've put an awful lot of work over the years into trying to get these really, you know, detailed charts that can produce that information and get it into the hands of people so they can judge for themselves. Most of the time was spent putting X's on these charts, like X marks the spec, because that's not an automatic thing. I should probably try to make it an automatic thing. But basically the idea is, you know, is the line in this case to the left of the X? Is it, you know, does it meet or exceed its spec? And pretty much across the board for all these different parts that we tested, you know, by and large, yeah, met or exceeded, in some cases exceeded by a lot, you know, where it was supposed to be. So pretty good stuff. But the point that we should probably spend a minute or two on is second to the last page in the article, which is where I took their Z SSD, which is called the 983 ZET, is the part name for it. This is the thing that's supposed to compete against Optane. And it's the thing Samsung has been talking about at various events over the past couple of years. In fact, I think this drive is already like the second generation of this Z NAND of theirs. And the thing we wanted to see was, okay, it's supposed to compete with it, maybe not beat Optane, but it's at least supposed to be close to the performance, right? Samsung, I don't think they were really portraying this as supposed to be like an Optane killer per se, but supposed to be pretty close. And what you can see in these charts is that while the average speed is not as fast, I mean, this is like about a half to a third of the absolute performance, like the random access and the latency and things. It's like between a half and a third of an Optane SSD, but it's still multiples of a NAND SSD. So the latencies look really good. It's for what it's supposed to do, it's definitely doing it. However, it's NAND. You have to remember, at the end of the day, it's still NAND flash. So it doesn't like things like mixed workloads. It doesn't handle them as well as something like Optane slash 3D Crosspoint can do. Because again, it's flash. You can only work so much of a miracle with flash memory. Samsung's done really well here, but you can really only, you know, the media can only be pushed so far at the end of the day. But things I did note, observations that were very interesting, was that the quality of service, the consistency of the performance, even though it was slower than Optane, there were plenty of cases where if you're doing only reads or only writes to the Z SSD, and as long as you're not loading it down too much, right, as long as you're only kind of feeding it requests at the rate that it can answer them, right? In other words, that would be referred to as low Q depth, like QD1 performance. It's actually significantly more consistent than Optane. So as fast as Optane is, once you get around to like about 1% of the requests that go to an Optane SSD end up going slower than that same, like, what's your worst 1% of the Z SSD from Samsung. And that extends all the way up to even further if you go all the way out to what's called 5.9s, which is basically, you know, okay, well, what about like the slowest 99.999%? I mean, you're basically getting to, you know, the slowest ever. at that point. Mm-hmm. You're one in, what is that? One in like 100,000 requests would be going, you know, that slow or whatnot. So very interesting to see, you know, as it was more consistent, but not like the absolute performance of the Optane drive. That last chart on that page shows an interesting data point there, which is, you know, how much can you load this thing down? Like, so this is a test called a write pressure test, which is you're seeing what's the latency of reads. At the same time, you're ramping up an amount of random writes that are going on in the background. So imagine, you know, this might be in a server where you have reads and writes going on at the same time. And, you know, how much does writing to it impact the speed of the reads that are also going on? And this is just a test where Optane usually shines. This is one of the types of charts that Intel even used to promote the data center Optane part when it came out, and putting overlaying what the ZSSD performance looked like on this chart shows that there is a clear difference. Like so if there's no on the left edge of the chart there, if there's no writing going on at all, the latency is almost double of what Optane is. But remember, still really fast. 17 microseconds is really fast for latency coming from NAND flash, which usually runs in the 60s or 80s. So really quick there. But as soon as you put any of a write load on it in the background, the latency of the reads immediately starts to climb. And it doesn't go anywhere near as far to the right on this chart as the Optane part does, because this drive can only handle like 70,000-80,000 write IOPS. So it's not even able to go, it's not even able to extend further on the chart because it just can't even handle the incoming writes past a certain point, which is okay because, again, this is not a product that's supposed to be phenomenal at incoming random writes. That's not what it's for. It's supposed to be more for like data analytics type stuff where you have a bunch of things that might normally have been stuff that you would put in a large amount of RAM that you're trying to access quickly and just randomly read from as you need to find things. And it's okay to have a device that goes a little bit slower than RAM as long as it's going faster than flash or way faster than a hard disk. Right, you can get away with sort of a budget proposition, you know. So don't buy a terabyte worth of RAM, which would be insanely expensive. Maybe buy one of these ZSSDs, you know, in a 960 gig form factor that can give you 960 gigabytes of something that you can access pretty darn quick. Not RAM speed, a little bit slower than Optane, but pretty quick. As I was writing this and looking at those results, especially that chart we were just looking at, I was tempering, you know, my enthusiasm for the Optane side. I was like, yeah, Optane really does well in this test, whereas this other product, not so much. But remember, the ZSSD is a cheaper product than the Optane parts. And as a matter of fact, I think that this device showing up on the market might have actually driven the price of the Optane SSDs down some, because Optane parts, when they launched the P4800X, which is Intel's Optane data center, like enterprise SSD, the counterpart to the ZSSD, I think that was running roughly double the price for the equivalent capacity of this ZSSD. I think once this came out, or at least once Intel caught wind that this was going to be a thing that people could buy, I think they've since lowered the price of the Optane parts. So now they're still more expensive than the ZSSD. Pricing is, if you scroll down another page there, we've got a bunch of pricing. And towards the bottom, you can see the ZSSD runs about $2.50 a gigabyte. The Intel parts run over $3 typically for the capacity you'd probably end up getting. But that 1.5 terabyte model is like $4.30 a gig. And it used to be the whole line was roughly $4 or $5 per gigabyte when they launched. So those prices have come down. Maybe Samsung might have to compete a little bit further on the pricing to make it a little bit more justifiable and make it, you know, more of a budget style. It's so silly. I'm talking about budget in something that has this insanely fast latency. but that's good, right? Like, we need competition especially in terms of Optane things. That was the most expensive storage devices you could buy. It's nice that there's something that can compete with that and kind of drive the price down, right?
Right.
Eventually getting into the hands of more people. Not to say that you're going to really need one of these for your gaming PC. Might be a little pricey, you know, but the enterprise stuff is always what ends up pushing you into, you know, it pushes into the consumer space later, right? So maybe down the road, Samsung decides to take one of these Z SSD chips and kind of toss it in with one of their regular NAND SSDs and make it like a cache. So instead of an SLC cache using the same media as the TLC or the QLC flash on the Samsung drive, maybe you just make a cache using this stuff, right?
Right.
And then you could actually get some better performance out of the cheaper consumer part. That's an example of how like a technology like this could trickle down into something that you end up getting in a consumer SSD. End result being, you get something with even better performance for, you know, the same or lower cost, you know, on the consumer side. Enterprise stuff historically is always, it always eventually trickles down to the consumer in one way, shape, or form. So just good to see technologies like this starting to catch on. you know, it's just really cool that you can access, you know, you can write to or read from a non-volatile thing in 20 microseconds or less these days.
That's pretty fast.
Yeah, we just keep pushing, you know, faster and faster on this. It's just cool stuff to see. So, and good on Samsung for actually making these things available to more folks that want to get their hands on this type of stuff. Again, I know the prices look good for the SATA stuff. It's like 30 cents a gig, which is actually pretty competitive for Samsung parts. But remember, it's meant for enterprise. Don't put it in your gaming PC. You know, buy like an 860 Evo or, you know, even a QVO drive if you're trying to go even more on a budget. Like, make sure if you're doing consumer stuff, even if you think you're right, super pro, if it's not like huge databases and SQL servers and stuff like that, don't go putting enterprise stuff in your system. It's kind of overkill, and sometimes it's not even a good fit.
Don't go breaking my heart.
Basically.
Well, let's talk about shifting gears a little bit. Let's talk about Crucial's P1 500 gigabyte and the 1 terabyte M.2 NVMe SSD. More QLC, as you put it. I actually near me, but not in my hands, I've got a Crucial that is going into my mini ITX build. I'm rehousing my 1800X. These looked really good. You gave him a gold PC per award. You know, yeah, 17 cents a gigabyte for the 1 terabyte. I mean, this is crazy. Let me make sure everybody understands. These are NVMe drives at 17 cents a gigabyte for 1 terabyte.
Mm-hmm.
That's and really
NVMe
cheap.
M.2 NVMe SSD and a reasonably good performing one. You know, I wouldn't really consider this budget. The performance is okay. now I say okay because I was comparing this against the Intel 660P, which is nearly identical. If you sit one of these next to the 660P and you peel the labels off of them, you can't even really tell there's a difference. It's the same controller. It's the flash is coming from the same place. It's Intel / Micron flash. So it's the same QLC rated IMFT flash memory on both products. So really the only difference has come down to how Crucial / Micron decided to tune the firmware on the Silicon Motion controller on this P1 versus what Intel did with their 660P. That's really all it's down to, because it's pretty much, it's virtually identical otherwise. And it looks like Micron chose to be a little bit more conservative on how they were dealing with their caching. So they were maybe trying a little harder to make sure that there was always cache available and you always had a relatively large amount of SLC so you can just dump large chunks of data on this drive and hopefully not run out of cache as often as possible. This drive and the 660P can do this trick, this dynamic caching trick, where it just treats all of the flash as just something that it can dynamically switch. It can run it in QLC mode, store 4 bits in a cell, or It can take the same page as a Flash, and it can just store one bit per cell, and it can do it much faster if it's doing that. But you can only store so much if you're doing one bit per cell mode, SLC mode. It looks like Crucial did the tuning in such a way where the absolute performance might not be as fast as the 660p and even other competing NVMe drives, or even the, you know, BPX Pro is actually a pretty solid performer there as well, looking at those charts. Give up a little bit on that, but then maybe gain some, in this case, gain some significantly in terms of caching performance. So if you go to the last couple of charts where we do our cache test, which is kind of an arduous test on these parts, usually what you would see is these are eight separate 60-second maximum speed writes that we do to the SSD, and we give different amounts of time. Basically, give the drive a break in between each 60 seconds, and we kind of make that break shorter and shorter during the test, to the point where if you're in the middle of that chart, we're only giving it 3 seconds of a breather between two 60-second continuous writes. Now, right. Usually you would see the cache run out somewhere on this chart. You know, maybe towards the middle, maybe across the whole thing. Crucial did a really good job on these. It makes it all the way through the test. It never really dips down to the speed of the QLC, meaning it never really runs out of cache. Now, yes, it has its limits. If you really beat the drive up a lot, I'm sure you could manage to do it, but you would have to try. Like, you would have to intentionally be trying to do it. And my caching test comes as close as you can to almost intentionally trying, but I'm still trying to keep it a little bit realistic. But it's still a pretty hard test. And as a comparison, there's even a link in that paragraph right after the cache test charts to the same page on the 660 peer review that kind of gives you an example of, and that chart's at the bottom of that page, gives you a look at what that cache test looked like on that drive. So again, same hardware, different firmware, different tuning, and you can tell that sometimes the Intel drive is going at the speed of the QLC, meaning it ran out of cache and it had to write at the speed of the it has to write much slower if you're trying to write in QLC mode, because it's much harder to be that precise on those writes, to store three more bits in every single cell, and be that efficient on your storage. So good stuff there. It's a little bit, pluses on one side, minuses on the other. You had to give something up to make the cache performance really good, and that makes the random performance and things like that be a little bit lower. But again, less than 20 cents a gig right out of the gate. Those are the prices direct from Crucial. The prices I put on the article, that's like the Crucial store pricing. And these kind of drives, I mean, think back to like the MX500 and the MX300. And those are the drives we typically see on sale on like Newegg and Amazon. And it's already a budget priced product. And then there's a sale and it's like another 20 or 30% off occasionally. So if you're starting at those prices on these and potentially, hopefully see those extra sales on top of it from some of the other vendors, man, that's just, solid NVMe SSD for really low prices, right? We're getting really close to that 10 cents per gig thing. We're at least, it's funny, NAND memory, some of the vendors back when the shrinking the processes was a big deal, like Intel would get down to something like, 25 nanometer, but they would just call it like 20 nanometer class, because like you're in the 20s, right? We're actually in the 10s now, for launch prices for not just SATA SSDs, but NVMe, right. Pretty good performance SSDs. Definitely good stuff. There really is no excuse anymore. If you're building a system, you should not have a spinning disk with your operating system on it. There's no reason. I mean, that's a half a terabyte SSD for $90.
That's pretty freaking awesome.
You know, and it's a good performing one, right? They're supposed to be, we didn't test it. It's not actually launched yet. There's supposed to be a 2 terabyte model of this as well. It's announced, there's specs on their website about it, but it's just not available yet. So if you, you know, if you were scoffing at the 1 terabyte and you wanted two, there's one coming. So, you know,
I had never been on this website before, but I'm delighted. It kind of reminds me of Small Net Builder in the sense that it's doing some stuff that's really hard to do and really interesting to look at. Servethehome.com is the webpage. And Sebastian's got a nice write-up on PC Per where they Serve the Home went into an Intel Optane DC persistent memory module, basically pulled the heat spreaders and started scraping the thermal paste off. I don't know how to, you know, de-slimed it.
I think they mentioned in their post, they actually did a video on this as well and kind of showed some details. It's interesting to see under the hood of this stuff because I don't have any yet. You know, we talked about this last week. This is that memory that's able to do 350 nanosecond access time to something that's persistent and saves its information when the power's off, right? So they got their hands on some. Presumably, I imagine they might be testing some server systems that, you know, are able to accept this memory and able to, you know, handle talking to it and whatnot. Looks like they had a few sticks of this. I think they had already disassembled this one that's showing up in the video because I'm pretty sure looking at those pictures that it was not thermal paste, that it was thermal adhesive, which is the kind of thing you usually use to glue the heatsink onto the thing, not just attach it and have it conduct heat. They mentioned in their article that this particular one doesn't work anymore. So they might have, I think in this video, it had already been removed one time because the guy's able to just pull the heat spreader off by hand. I think that they might have had to use some more aggressive prying the first time around, and that led to damaging the thing. So I'm glad somebody took it apart because even if I got one sampled for review, now that I know it's thermal adhesive, I wouldn't be taking it apart. And you know me, I take everything apart.
True.
I would not want to do that to this. But cool to see under the hood and how it works. And like, you know, looks like there's an FPGA in there. So there's an actual controller in there. Meaning that if the computer requests some information from this, it has to go through a controller and then to the 3D crosspoint media, then back through the controller and back out the bus. You have to do something like that because this is not RAM. You still have to manage it to some extent. So that's why you would need that controller in there. Kind of makes sense. But just to be able to know now that it has to make these extra hops and do these extra things, and it's not just cross-point memory directly connected to a bus, it's even more impressive that it's able to have that fast of a response time. Compared to 10 microseconds of the PCI Express Optane stuff that has a controller and then has the media behind the controller, this is, yes, it's able to communicate via a DIMM slot, but it still has to go through a controller and do those same kind of steps. It's just able to do it in like a fraction of the time, which is impressive in its own right. So yeah, good to see somebody took it apart. I'm glad it wasn't me, and I'm glad I didn't break it. Let somebody else break it.
Glad they didn't break it either, as far as we know.
Well, I think it doesn't work anymore. I think the one they took apart doesn't work anymore.
Well,
yeah.
Ouch.
They have more that does work.
And yet, I still feel ouch. Something I caught up on a hard OCP earlier today. TSMC receives permits to start construction of its 3-nanometer foundry. So
three
nanometer chip factory, Southern Taiwan Science Park in Taiwan. They got through their EPA study. They're going to use 20% renewable energy, 50% recycled water. The same site's also going to house the 5-nanometer fab, which is apparently going to be, quote, up and running by late 2019. The 3-nanometer foundry, don't worry. Well, it depends on whether you're looking at it. It's 2023, I think, is the date for for the actual 3-nanometer fab to start running. But I just want to make sure that we all remember as we're heading towards CES, TSMC is looking for 5-nanometer production in 2019. Will they hit it? Will Intel ever hit? Well, you know, we've been talking about this for a year.
I would imagine, okay, so 3-nanometer is an impressive number.
But 5-nanometer is an impressive number.
They're both impressive numbers. But you have to remember, it's not necessarily absolutely related to the feature size anymore, the way that some of this stuff works. So it's almost like so many nanometer equivalent, right? So imagine if you can slightly kind of like, you can kind of cheat it and you can kind of take some of this stuff and kind of overlay it, or, you know, maybe not make it 3D, so to speak, but you're kind of taking advantage of Z height there and you're kind of doing some other tricks to make it so that maybe if you looked at it under a microscope, the individual features might not be at a resolution of that small, but you know, the amount of space compared to how many things were crammed in there might give you like an equivalent of that smaller number. And I think it's kind of been that way for the past generation or two, actually.
Well,
and even if you can make features that small, you can't really make like complex features that small. Like you might be able to make a trace that small or something. You know, it's just, this stuff's hard.
I'm the last person to question that it's hard. I'm just saying, you know, if this works, it puts them that much little bit more ahead of Intel.
That's true. That's true. Even to make any sort of chip, you know, with a 3-nanometer claim, right?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's going to be a real good year for AMD.
If
things keep going the way they're going. So
AMD, just like how those Samsung SSDs were pulling the price of the Intel thing down on the storage side. Now you got AMD that's coming out with things that are causing Intel to rethink some of their CPU stuff and potentially even pull prices down there. Man, what's this competition thing? Right?
Like free markets, free marketing, people. I'm down with that.
It's good stuff.
Speaking of free markets and money and stuff like that, let's talk about something I think if you're in business, if you're a business person, capital, right? Money. Money is the fuel of business. OnDeck is 100% committed to small business owners with fast, easy, tailored financing. Your time is valuable. OnDeck is going to try to get you funding in as fast as 24 hours, term loans up to $500,000, lines of credit up to $100,000, none of which require business collateral. So if you don't have a big warehouse full of machinery or something, this is great. This is an opportunity for you to get a loan, people. The application process is simple. You can apply online or by phone. You can get approved in minutes, and it will not impact your personal credit. Does this sound good? It gets better. OnDeck delivers some of the best customer service in the U.S., A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. This is great. They've lent over $10 billion to over 80,000 small business owners, and they carry a 9.8 out of 10 rating on Trustpilot. OnDeck is a secure financing service that business owners everywhere can truly rely on. Their simple and secure web platform and mobile app make it easy to access your account anytime, anywhere. If you're a small business owner and need access to capital, go to ondeck.com/twitch right now. And as a listener of This Week in Computer Hardware, you'll receive a free consultation with one of their U.S.-based loan specialists. Apply online or by phone and get approved in minutes. Go to ondeck.com/twitch. That's ondeck.com/TWICH for your free consultation now. That's ondeck.com/twitch, and we want to thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh my goodness. We had a little bit of fun this week, or I had some fun this week, something I've been playing around with, and I'm going to hold one of them up for you right now. Ergonometric mice, which basically means instead of the buttons being flat and the mouse being, well, that looks like flat, this particular one is a Logitech MX Vertical. It's wireless. It'll do Bluetooth, USB-C, or of course, one of the dongles, the unification dongles, unifying dongles from Logitech. And I got to say, this feels really nice to use. Now, a lot of people, there's some questions for some people whether or not ergonometric mice actually solve problems or just sort of shift them about. But I will say, as somebody uses a trackball at a higher angle, that 57-degree angle is really, really nice. They have controls up to 4,000, or they have a high-resolution sensor on this. They're like, you don't have to move your head that much. Turn the resolution up or turn the resolution down. Whatever makes you happy, up to 4,000 DPI, like a nominal 1,000 or 1600 DPI. I will say one of my favorite things is if with the Logitech software that comes bundled to control this. If you're using this across multiple machines, right? You can, you know, Logitech lets you kind of bond the mouse or keyboard with multiple machines. You can actually cut and paste from, you know, if the software is running on both machines, you can cut and paste from one machine to another, which I find deeply fascinating. just because it's like it's magic. I can cut on machine A and paste on machine B as long as they're connected on the same network with the Logitech software. But it's been interesting to play around with these because at the same time, we had this one for $99. It's rechargeable. They're like, you know, I think I want to say like a 4-month charge once it's fully charged. You get a couple, 3 hours use out of like a 10 or 15 minute charge. Cherry of keyboard fame or key fame also has their MW4500, which uses a pair of AAA batteries, has a dongle, no other way to connect it, but is running a whopping $26. Now, for $26, you don't get something that feels as nice in your hand. The Logitech MX Vertical's got a little bit more heft to it, but you get a simpler operation, no customization, and a really inexpensive price. 45-degree angle, which I got to say I don't like quite as much as that 57-degree angle on the MX Vertical, but it is not a bad ergonometric mouse for the money. 3 DPI adjustments, 600, 900, or 1200 DPI. You have sort of a page forward, page back key under your thumb, or maybe that's the Logitech that I'm holding as I'm playing around with those keys on it. But if you're looking for some mousing options, they're definitely out there. And, you know, it was interesting to see a couple for ergonometric mice show up, or ergonomic, maybe I should say, mice show up this year and finally get my grubby little paws on them. In lighter news, this is like the worst headline ever, but it's awesome. It's a great headline. No insult to anybody over the Verge, but it's awful, an awful thing that it's saying. Apple confirms some iPad Pros ship slightly bent, but says it's normal. Now, before you get,
is it like you're holding it wrong? Is that how this is? This one of those again?
It could be. Apple actually admitted to The Verge that some of those 2018 iPad Pros, they have, quote, a very slight bend in the aluminum chassis, but this is a side effect of the manufacturing process, and shouldn't change its performance, shouldn't get worse, and Apple, most importantly, does not... Look at that! It's not square. It's not true.
I think it should be straighter than that. I mean, I hate to be picky, but it's an expensive thing. It should not come out of the box. I mean, I can... The counter to this is, yes, there are fools out there that are getting these things and doing videos where they're folding them in half and stuff like that. And look, it's not meant to be that strong, but it should come out of the box straight.
Yeah.
You see what I don't think that's too much to ask. Especially really from confusing. Yeah.
No, apparently it's I'm going to quote Chris Welch from The Verge on this. Quote, "The bend is a result of a cooling process involving the iPad Pro's metal and plastic components during manufacturing, according to Apple," end quote. I can hear the Master Chief's mind grinding on that right now.
that's obvious. I mean, just look. You don't even have to look down the edge, which might be being kind of picky. I mean, that's like, unless that's lens distortion from the picture, that's obviously a bend. Yeah. It's crooked. I mean, like, come on. They got to do better than that.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't imagine, you know, I couldn't hear Johnny Ives' voice, you know, talking about this precision bend in this thing and how it was, you know, every detail was paid such attention to and that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, this is not, yeah.
You're not
from Apple. Apple usually makes straight devices that don't come bent out of the box. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. You were looking at the DeepSpar Gardonyx. What is that? Tell me more.
Got it right here. I got it right here. It comes in this cute little tube. DeepSpar are the guys that make, chances are, if you have sent a hard drive or an SSD off to any of the companies that do data recovery, chances are the hardware in their lab, or at least some of that hardware, has a DeepSpar logo on it. These are the guys that make most of the hardware that does data recovery. And the Gardonyx, which is this cute little box with a couple of USB ports on it. This guy is them sort of venturing into the data forensics / write blocking arena. So it's kind of like two separate animals, right? It's almost like two separate groups of folks, right? You have your data recovery folks. Those guys might sometimes do things that are related with forensics. But in my experience, because I used to do a job that kind of related with this, you know, if you worked in a shop that needed to do forensic analysis of hard drives, you need to get all the data off. You need to make an image of the drive so then you can look at the image later. And if it was like a law enforcement thing, you're looking for evidence for a case or something. Or if it was you're trying to figure out if a system was compromised and look after the fact and look for data evidence of somebody trying to, you know, sneak into the system or whatnot. Right. That's usually the kind of thing that happens. But the forensics guys usually they have their write blocking hardware, which is a thing you could plug in. That's you're able to later say in court, Your Honor, we only plugged this device in through a write blocker. So there's no way we could have altered the data that was stored on the drive. It's like a chain of custody evidence kind of thing. Right. You need to be able to prove that you didn't mess, you know, with any of that data. Usually that sphere is separate from the data recovery sphere. So if you're in a shop doing forensics, you get a hard drive in, you go to image it, and you ran into a drive that had some bad sectors at the beginning. Usually that would cause that to fail. The write blocking hardware, in my experience, doesn't gracefully handle errors. It's not meant to be a data recovery thing, right?
Right.
Whereas on the flip side, the data recovery hardware guys, they're all about, maybe they're not certified to be write blocking, but usually data recovery hardware will never write to the thing you're trying to recover data from. That's just kind of a side effect. So, but the shop would usually have to send a drive off to a data recovery place if they ran into a drive with errors. They couldn't finish the case. They have to put it on hold. It's kind of a pain in the butt. So what if you could make a thing that behaved like a write blocker, but maybe it had a few bit of those data recovery style features in there? Like, what if it didn't fall on its face when it ran into a bad sector and just timed out and, like, you had to start over and things?
Right.
Data recovery software or data forensics software is not usually very good about handling errors. It usually is just like, well, the thing crashed. We got to start over. You know, and say it's a 10 terabyte hard drive that takes hours and hours to image and whatever. Like, you don't want to have to do that. Right. So this little guy, I kind of put it through some torture tests. It's pretty darn cool. So since it is sitting in the middle between the drive and the system, it's able to do some other tricks that these DeepSpar guys have figured out how to do. When you plug either a USB drive into this, or you can even have a USB dock, they have some limitations on which they have like a favored USB controller that needs to be in the dock. I think they favor As Media hardware because it has some extra commands that they can do that As Media chips are able to do some extra tricks that help for data recovery.
Right.
So you could have like a SATA hard drive and USB dock connected to this and then connected to the system. Or if it was like a flash drive, you could just have it connected direct into the, you know, USB type A port on this, which is handy if you're trying to do data recovery from a flash drive, right?
Right.
You connect it up. Once the drive gets connected, the Gardonyx box sort of emulates that drive all the way up to the point where not only can it handle like if the data times out or if the hard drive has bad sectors on it and it's taking forever to read, this box keeps that connection to the PC, and it keeps it's as if the drive was never disconnected or never timed out as far as the PC is concerned. So where this helps is Windows is kind of finicky. Linux is better, but Windows is kind of finicky, if there's an error and there's timeouts. If there's enough of them, Windows, the kernel kind of assumes that there's something wrong with the USB device, and eventually it'll just go away.
Right.
And you'll have to like unplug it, plug it back in order to even, you know, and then now you've unplugged it, and now the forensic software thinks that there's not even a drive there anymore. So it just fails, right? It just, the process just fails. So with this device, it's able to, regardless of what the connected thing is to this box, mm-hmm. You know, it's handled more gracefully all the way up to the point, I think later in that video, it might be kind of hard to find. You can go as far as pulling the hard drive out of the dock and plugging it back in. And the system never knew that the drive was disconnected. So, you know, cool stuff. And there's like a pro feature. It's like a software unlockable thing. Like you get a license for it to enable it. But it gives you even more control over that sort of error recovery of the device. So you can actually control how, if you want long timeouts or short timeouts. And since the DeepSpark guys kind of like researched, okay, can we get some of these USB controller chips to cooperate a little better and do some of our tricks? They're actually able to send resets to even the hard drive in a dock. They can send a reset command that will go through to the hard drive and basically like sort of reboot the firmware of the hard drive. So that's a trick you do. Instead of waiting 30 seconds to a minute for a bad sector to time out, you can do it just after like a second. Like, oh, we didn't get our data. We didn't get our data in a second. Not long enough. Obviously, there must be an error. We don't have time for this. We just want to get past this and try to get the rest of the data, right? So you just sends it a reset. And then if the drive fails to come back from the reset, because sometimes there's firmware-related errors, it can even, I think it can even send another command to the Asmedia chip, which actually power resets the drive. So you know the hard drive will probably come back if you like literally remove power and put power back. So it has some extra, you know, data recovery style tricks up its sleeve, in addition to doing the write blocking thing. And you know, it's marketed more as a forensic shop product. Mm-hmm. It's actually priced similar to what forensic, you know, certified sort of write blocking hardware is priced at. It's on the pricey side. You know, you probably shouldn't run out and buy one of these if you're just trying to recover data from one of your drives. But we looked previously, a couple of years back, we looked at the RapidSpar, which was a subset of data recovery hard drive or data recovery hardware meant more for like a smaller shop sort of thing. But it still costs like a grand or two. So to have something like this, granted it's not as feature rich as the RapidSpar, but this device is able to do USB recoveries. That's something that the RapidSpar actually couldn't do. I think they're going to make an add-on eventually for it to make that one of the things that you can add to it later. But as it stands now, this is like probably the best game in town for USB based device, you know, write blocking slash data recovery, right? You might want to get it for either purpose. And it's kind of, it's like a crossover product that tries to, you know, reach into both of those markets. And in my experience, I mean, it's, you know, pretty cool. It very gracefully handles errors on things that would, you know, Windows would usually choke at. I even had, you know, those CES USB drives we get?
Uh-huh.
That have all like media kits and stuff on it, and then you try to use it like a normal drive, and it almost immediately, you know, barfs because it's not It's a very, it's like a $1 USB drive that's not really meant to last a long time. I had a couple of those from CES that didn't even, you couldn't even access the media kit that was on them. And then I just threw it in a drawer because I have a drawer full of like, you know, CES USB drives. I dug through the drawer, found one of those drives, and was able to read the media kit off of it using this device because it was able to get past the, what was timing out, which I'm assuming might have, you know, just been somewhere else on the drive. Maybe it was whenever you plug a drive into a Windows machine, it, Windows actually does a write to the drive. It's not overwriting your data. It's just it's updating something in the file table or just something on the drive saying, like, you mounted the partition. This thing was able to let me get past that point so I can actually read the information off the drive. So, you know, it works, clearly. And able to get access to things you might not have been able to get access to. And, you know, in the case of forensics, get your case done, hopefully without the headache of having to send a drive off to a data recovery shop. You know, it's just a matter of getting past that bad spot sometimes. You might not be losing, you know, maybe that bad sector was not the thing that you absolutely needed to read in order to get what you needed off of the drive, right? So,
get what cool you stuff. Need, people.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Let's talk about buying a home for a minute. Speaking of things that can be painful and traumatic, interest rates are rising. A lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying a home these days. Anxiety, trauma, fear, panic. Nah, our friends at Quicken Loans, they're going to make life easier for you. They're calling it the power buying process. Here's how it works. Step one, answers. If you can answer a few simple questions, they're going to check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Step two, Quicken Loans verifies your income, your assets, and your credit in less than 24 hours. They're going to give you a verified approval to give you the strength of a cash buyer. Step three, once you're verified, you qualify for their all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They're going to lock your rate up for up to 90 days while you shop. If rates go up, they keep your rate the same. Your rate doesn't go up, but if rates go down, your rate drops. Doesn't matter which way things go, you win, people. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. And we want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, my goodness. Hey, I want to do a quick mention. I've talked about One More as headphones. Of course, you heard me talk about Sony's, MDR7506, the over-ear headphones from Sony. I was talking to Lauren Dragan from The Wirecutter earlier this week, and I guess she's been writing for The Wirecutter about headphones for about 6 years. I think she's listened to over 1,000 headphones, and that model has been the best headphone under $200 on The Wirecutter for pretty much the entire time she's been there. Which one I think makes it it's just a classic headphone. It's a fantastic sounding headphone. It's an incredible bargain for the money. But it's so rare to see something where a company gets it right, keeps it going, and doesn't try to fix anything by making it better. Earbuds, I don't think we really have an earbud where it's the ultimate earbud for the sort of, you know, all people all the time. I'm a huge fan of One More's triple driver. The performance they deliver for the money that for like $100, maybe as low as $79, depending on when you shop, is pretty fantastic. Some people feel they have a bit more of an emphasis on the highs than they like. And I want to give a shout out to a company called Periodic Audio. And the one I'm holding up right now is that's the Periodic Audio Beryllium. That is their more high-end earbud. That actually literally has a pure beryllium driver inside of it. And what's crazy is the folks that run Beryllium, Dan Wiggins, he's been behind a lot of amazing audio products from Sonos, from Focal. He does high-end speakers that he designs. He does some pretty amazing work in all sorts of other spaces. Started out actually working with Sonar in submarines. But that Beryllium is one of the best earbuds I've heard. They sell for about $299. But the other one that I think might apply for more folks that are listening right now is the Periodic Audio Magnesium. That sells for $99. And they're pretty impressive. They use the same enclosure, the same injection molded enclosure for all of, or housing for all of their earbuds. What they change is the driver. They have a 5-year guarantee on these. That's pretty incredible for an earbud. Free tips, basically contact them to get more tips for them. You know, if you like bass, if you like a little bit of thud in your music, you should definitely, if you can, get a chance to listen to these. And they are pretty slick. I have been really impressed with these. They have not disintegrated with some pretty aggressive use. And I just want to give a shout out to periodicaudio.com. They're available on amazon.com. And I think the Beryllium, if you're looking for a more high-end experience, a supremely detailed, really beautiful audio experience. And if you're looking for something that sounds better than the average $99 earbud, definitely give thoughts to the Periodic Audio Magnesium. It's good stuff, people. Just wanted to give them a shout out for anybody that's looking for a little bit better audio in their life. So we wanted to talk about, we're at the tail end of the year, we're getting ready for CES. You know, we've been watching VR all year. I've had some really cool experience with games. We'll talk some more about that in a couple seconds. I think it's interesting to see where PC VR is going. And also, I saw this billboard. I was going to Costco. There's this huge billboard at the intersection. And it basically came down to Oculus Go. It's for consuming media, like movies. It's not really a VR thing. And I was thinking, okay. Didn't know that.
It's like they're trying to find more ways to sell it, sort of.
Well,
right?
Well, there's a lot of conversations about whether or not the gaming experience on that is subpar because they don't have sort of 6 degrees. But the thing that a lot of friends of mine that do a lot of VR, create for VR, the Oculus Quest, I think, is what a lot of people are excited about, which is they're, you know, more high-end than the Oculus Go, self-contained headset and full controllers rather than that sort of single, you know, single-handed controller that you get with the Oculus Go. And this, of course, is coming. And a lot of question marks around what's going to happen with the Oculus Rift and whether or not HTC Vive and gaming. But I want to give a shout-out of that because I was thinking a lot about that because I'm very curious to see how the Oculus Quest turns out. Because, you know, Oculus seems to have sort of more more things going awesome. There just seems to be, that seems to be where the momentum on the gaming side of things is going or should be going or people feel will be going. But I also want to give a shout out to, you know, they had some great articles this week on The Verge. PlayStation VR had a quietly awesome year. Now, I don't do a lot with PlayStations because my wife will quietly, you know, kill me in my sleep if I start bringing consoles into the house because she's not a big fan of consoles. But, you know, this is Jeff Cannata was shouting out about this. A lot of people I know are basically talking about Astrobot. It's a PlayStation game. People love it. People are calling it like the VR game of the year. And it's something to think about that while, you know, maybe Oculus and HTC got a huge amount of the coverage. Maybe the real success for games is going to be on a gaming platform for gamers where, you know, game companies make games. So I just want to give a shout out and you know, try to figure out how I might be able to sneak a PlayStation VR into my house without ending up divorced or sneak over, you know, to go to my friend's house. Hey, man, can we play PlayStation? to get some eyeballs on time with Astrobot. But it's interesting to watch this. I'll be very curious to hear if we hear much of anything about VR at CES this year from what I will affectionately call sort of legitimate VR vendors, not the like, we have the most extraordinary mobile VR experience with ponies. There are no games, but we have hardware you can buy for $99. It's going to be amazing. Not to mock, but I'm mocking. But I'm kind of curious to see where VR goes in the next few months and if the Oculus Quest is going to be something that drives a huge amount of gaming in the universe or not. But I'm curious about that.
Yep.
I'm curious.
Or some rumors about Valve making their own headset too, right? Like they got a bunch of prototypes that leaks keep coming out. And whatnot. Leaked pictures. You know, and there's been some other, there was, I forget what the name of it was, but there was that crazy headset with like the two 4K displays in it that was on a Kickstarter for a while. And then they make like a 5K version of it and whatnot. And I forget the company that makes it, but like there's basically, there's more VR stuff coming. It's getting to the point where like people are trying to toy around with different things like that. The one that I can't remember the name of, like the idea was to get a really high field of view. So in other words, like if you've used VR headsets, it's kind of like looking through, not binoculars, but you know, there is a, there are circles there, right? You're looking through, you can't really like move your eye all the way over and, you know, see stuff, right? There's kind of like a range. There you go. Pimax makes like new headsets where instead of having a single display kind of stuck in there that your both of your eyes are looking at, each looking at a half of the display, they just went crazy with the thing, as you can tell by the look of the front of it. There's two full displays in there, one for each eye, which gives you a much wider, just what's called a field of view, right? So when you're looking, you're actually, it looks like you're actually looking just out into a room, you know. Be it through a set of glasses as opposed to through like a set of binoculars as an example. So just interesting to see all these different solutions kind of coming out and hopefully competing with each other, and even more hopefully maybe driving some of the price down on some of the things, like the Vive Pro, which is just insanely overpriced. You know, there needs to be more competition, just like all that AMD, Intel, NVIDIA, you know, flash, SSD, CPU, whatever competition we were talking about earlier. We kind of could use some competition in this space to bring the prices down, because I think the price might be the one of the bigger prohibitive, like the thing stopping it from really starting to catch on, right? Like,
need more games too.
Yeah, we do. You know. But again, it's this big chicken and the egg thing, right? You got the hardware, and then you've got the software, and then they both have to kind of develop and, you know, do this symbiotic thing. And if the hardware is really expensive, or if there's, or you know, it's kind of standardized, like there's this somewhat overlap, like you can use Oculus stuff on Steam and, you know, whatnot. Like there's sort of ways to kind of translate and make one kit work with the other set of software. So that's good in that respect. I'm glad it didn't turn into like a Blu-ray versus HD DVD thing. But that aside, But that aside, the hardware, generally speaking, is still kind of pricey. And there is some of that in just taking this AstroBot game as an example, right? That's on PSVR. You can't, if you spent $1,000+ on a Vive Pro, you ain't playing that game. It's on the other system, right? Oculus Rift, sorry. You know, it's not happening. It's on the, now granted, for the most part, I think that's been more like a PSVR kind of thing. Like I think there's more, you know, platform specific titles on PSVR versus on the PC side, where if you have a Vive or a Rift, chances are you can play the games from the, you know, from the other party, right? You can make that work. There's ways to do it. PSVR, not so much, right? You have to have that piece of kit to play that game. And granted, it's really good in terms of, you know, that's how they sell consoles. But, you know, I just, it holds you back. It holds VR overall back, because, you know, if that's a killer game, there should be plenty of people that are just, you know, diehard PC folk. Maybe they don't even have any consoles and they're not going to buy one just for that one game, as killer app as it is. You know, so it kind of holds the VR thing as a whole back, which is unfortunate, but hopefully we'll get past all that at some point. And then everybody will just be running around like in Ready Player One, just putting on their little thing, and that's their whole life, and just playing around in VR all day.
All day.
All day.
Oh, my goodness. Playing around all night? Thinking about playing? I was going to make a segue, but it just suddenly seemed incredibly awkward. I just want to say mattress shopping usually sucks. It's painful. It's just, oh, spend 3 minutes on this bed in the store while somebody's haranguing you or ignoring your questions, and then spend a giant pile of money. Well, this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Casper is revolutionizing the mattress industry by cutting the cost of dealing with resellers and showrooms and passing the savings directly to you. Casper's mattress, I mean, it's really simple. Obsessively engineered. They want to give you a fair price. They want to give you an amazing mattress. The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And right there, ladies and gentlemen, you saw Leo Laporte bouncing if you're watching the video. Plus, its breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulate your temperature through the night. A Casper mattress provides long-lasting comfort and support. You can buy it easily online, without going to a store, without getting upsold, without getting irritated, risk-free. It's nice, right? Casper understands, you know, 5, 10, 20 minutes, a half an hour nap in the store is not really going to give you a good idea of how well this mattress feels. I know I bought a mattress and about 15 minutes after the return time was up, we started having problems with it. Casper, they're giving you free delivery, painless returns within a 100-day period. There's 365 days in a year. They'll give you 100 of them. So you don't have to lie down in a showroom, so you can feel how Casper fits with your sleep style. Casper Mattresses upholds the highest environmental production standards and are made in the USA. Free shipping and returns to the US and Canada. Do yourself a favor. Get a Casper mattress today. You can save $50 towards select mattresses by going to casper.com/twitch and entering the promo code TWICH at checkout. That's casper.com/twitch with promo code twitch to save $50 on select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply, and we want to thank Casper for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. If I sneeze, I want to apologize, but before I start sneezing, I want to give a shout-out. It was a really nice review, Sebastian Peak over at PC Per. This is a massive air cooler. Scythe built this one. This is the Ninja 5. It's a follow-up to the Ninja 4. I actually have a Ninja 4 sitting in this giant case down to my right. This thing is huge. It looks like a six-pack. It is not that big, but if you scroll down a little bit at the shot of it on top, this is a lot of surface area. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. There it is. And then scroll one more. This thing is huge. And it's huge because the more surface area you have, the more heat you can pull off your processor and dissipate in the air. It pays off. If you take a look at the cooler temperatures that Sebastian got, Intel Core i7-7700 stock, Corsair H100i Pro Extreme, 46.5 degrees. The Scythe Ninja 5, 47.9 degrees. That is a lot easier to install than even the incredibly easy Corsair liquid cooling. And it's fairly quiet too. It's kind of amazing looking at the Corsair H100 Pro. When you look at this chart, right? If you scroll down to the next chart, there's the H100 Pro, the H115, I Platinum, the Corsair H. Basically, look at all these liquid coolers. They're all running at 30 to 31 dB, whether they're at idle or low. The Scythe Ninja 5, 31.5 or 32.8 dB, fundamentally is going to disappear in the noise of your average house. Now, you can turn up the Corsairs up to an extreme. You can get way up there to 39 or 44 dB. But this is a really impressive piece of hardware. And it's actually $59.99. That's the MSRP. And the Ninja 4, which is also a very good air cooler, is selling for like $35 until the end of the month. I want to say until the day after Christmas. This is really impressive. If you're not a crazed overclocker, you should probably put this one on your short list. If you're not, I love that air coolers come in the box with most processors, but it can be enormously difficult to, not hear the inexpensive. We tossed a cooler in the box because it's what people do in this industry. Spend the extra money, get an air cooler, get something that's quieter, more efficient, and is going to pull more heat off your processor. Props to Scythe. Ninja 5 looks really good, and it looks really big, which amuses me. But this is a really impressive performance on that, and not quite shipping yet. I suspect it's going to show up just as soon as they run out of Scythe 4s after Christmas. It'd be nice if it was showing up now, but keep it on your list if you got a PC build coming up in the new year.
They're definitely moving those Scythe 4s on Newegg for like $35. That's even I picked one up last night. I was like, yeah, I looked over my CPU core. I was like, I could stand to upgrade that for $35.
In the feel-good stories, I just want to give a shout-out to 343 Industries, Microsoft's 343 Industries, I should say, partnered up with Limbitless. And this is pretty awesome. If you don't know who 343 Industries are, you might know them as the people who make Halo. And they partnered up with Limbitless to do Halo-themed 3D printed prosthetics for kids. It's pretty awesome. So if you want to Master Chief your child who needs an artificial limb, it's pretty cool. Head over to limbitless-solutions.org and take a look at what they've got there. I just want to give a shout out to that. At limbitless3d if you're on Twitter, or limbitless-solutions.org. Props to the crew at 343 Industries / Microsoft / the Halo people for doing something cool for kids. I think that's really, really awesome. Also really, really awesome, but for completely different reasons, Elizabeth Lopato over at The Verge. And we'll just do a quick mention of this. Took a ride through Elon Musk's new tunnel in California.
I would say I saw this. It's kind of rough around the edges, but you got to start somewhere, right? Like,
you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like I would imagine it's not the end goal experience. But it is a tunnel. You drive a car through it. You know, it's good stuff. It's I don't know how this is going to catch on in society and everything, and if in the future, sometime in the future, we're just going to be driving around in tunnels all the time.
I don't know.
I'm from New York. I'm from New York. There's plenty of tunnels.
Eventually, the tunnels get clogged. I will be curious, right? They got a test tunnel in Hawthorne. They got one for Dodger Stadium in L.A. They got one in Chicago, one in the D.C. Those are the announced projects. They're talking about getting contact from lots of cities that are curious. They're also dealing with a lot of, they have environmental impact studies to do. Residents and community groups have sued them. I'm kind of curious to see how this turns out. Apparently they've already spent like 40, quote, I think it's what Elon Musk said, quote, 40 million ish. That 1 mile test tunnel, it's 1 mile, 1 mile. It took a year and a half to finish and something like 10 million. And apparently that's not counting research or development or equipment. And I also thought it was interesting, it's a really kind of informed comparison that that Ms. Lopato is putting together, because she points out that the Silver Line in Washington, D.C. was $300 million per mile. The New York, the Second Avenue the Second Avenue subway that was started in New York and got killed off by the financial crisis in New York City, they're talking about like $2.5 billion per mile. So. Right. I'm really curious to see where it ends up.
If you can figure out how to do it more cost effective and maybe not stick them everywhere, but I'm sure there's plenty of places where it's just a really dense area and you need more road there, or you just need some way to just bypass a city or something, and there's just no way to go over it because of buildings or whatnot. If you can go under, why not? Right, I'm sure it has its place.
Yeah, I'm curious. Yeah. It's if you've been curious, if you're an Elon Musk fan, if you're an Elon Musk hater, something to take a look at. I'm always fascinated. Every time I just watching SpaceX land on a barge just blows my mind every time I see it. So, ladies and gentlemen, with that, we got to wrap up this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton. You can find me over at TechThing, TechThing.com or AVExcel.com. And guess what? We talk about computers. We talk about home theater. We talk about audio. We talk about fun stuff at AVExcel. I should know it at this point, the name of that. And, of course, TechThing.com is the weekly show I do with Shannon Morris. You can find Alan Malventano over at PCPer.com. You may have noticed at the beginning of this show, we talked about a lot of SSD stuff. That is his specialty there. And, of course, you can find all the latest GPU reviews, CPU reviews, and so much more over at PCPer.com. If you haven't been there, take some time. Go there. It's good stuff. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we got a bomb because somebody's starting right up after us. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Alan Malventano.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.